All right, Wyatt Claypool, thanks for joining us. You know, it's funny because we, I don't think Darren and I really talked much about your work, but along the same, along these parallel lines, we were both sort of individually watching you, and then you kept coming up the last couple of weeks, and then Darren booked you. So, yeah, it's good to talk to you about some Canadian politics. So, welcome.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. It's good to know that I'm finally getting that organic traction where somebody didn't need to share me to somebody else for them to start watching.
Yeah, we both found, I think we both found you, you know, because we have shared certain shows, but we both found you independently and organically. And I was like, this guy's from where, Calgary, I guess, or close to Calgary?
Yeah, yeah, in Calgary.
And I had just moved away from there. And I'm like, oh, this sounds awesome to have a, you know, smart dude sort of pushing back and telling his story from Calgary, Alberta. So, but now I'm in the middle of Saskatchewan and Darren's moved a little bit further out of the city too. So,
well, you two are smarter than us all because you understand where all the cheaper housing is.
Yeah, and the freedom. I mean, this is the thing. The other thing I find about rural, I mean, Ontario is kind of the same way, but Ontario has a police problem because I spent the first half of my life in rural Ontario. And you can get in the middle of nowhere. You can get even to a small town. I grew up in a town with like 3,000, maybe 4,000 people, and there were so many cops. It was crazy, that whole OPPP thing. Whereas I find in Alberta and Saskatchewan, it's like, you know, they might make all these weird globalist sort of communist leaning laws and this and that. But Alberta, you could always just, once you get out of that city, nobody really cares. You know, nobody's going to bother. You get out into rural Alberta, start shooting your guns off and doing this and that. And really nobody's going to bother you. But the reason I ended up out here was really because, I was kind of let down by the, even in Calgary, when the COVID stuff started happening, I was kind of, it was a real letdown to just see, you know, everyone just sort of go along with it. I was in Chestermere, and even my neighbors, it was getting to the point where, you know, I had the cops come to my house because I wasn't, when I was supposed to stay in, I was supposed to self-isolate because I went out of the country and I didn't. So I had the cops at my house, and it just turned into this weird thing where it didn't really matter how small of a town you're in. Like, you know, in our town, it was hard to know where everyone was, but, you know, you couldn't really have anyone over, or everyone was sort of looking at you funny. And what I noticed then was just once you got out of the city and you got into rural Alberta, nobody cared. You know, you'd pull up at your buddy's farm, and there'd be 20 cars there, there'd be a bonfire, and nobody's was ever going to do anything about that sort of thing. It seemed to be really a city problem, which extrapolated to me that as all this sort of comes down, and I don't know what your thoughts on are on where Canada's headed over the next decade, but right now it's not looking great. And it's like there's levels of authoritarianism that are creeping into the country that I would have thought were non-starters even 5 to 10 years ago. And I just feel like that's where it's really going to start. The clampdowns are going to start in the city. That's where you're going to start to see the first like real losses of freedom in this country.
Well, and I think it's that there's so many people have stewed in the idea that, you know, saying anything that sounds American must be radical and bad. So if you want to insist on, you know, full free speech rights, the ability to retain your own property, to be able to control your own movements, that sounds American. I mean, we can't do American things. So we got to like basically shoot ourselves in the foot just because we heard an American wouldn't do that. And then, but yeah, you're right. Like rural Canada in general is where you know, frankly, you bump into a lot of common sense because people aren't busybodies. You don't have this kind of nervous middle-class energy of people not wanting to do anything wrong, anything that the legacy media people wouldn't like, even though you shouldn't care. You shouldn't care what these people think because nobody watches them. Nobody actually really cares about them except the nervous middle-class people who think other people care, even though they in their own hearts don't care.
Is that what it boils? I mean, because you kind of got that thought during COVID. I'll go back to that again because, you know, I mean, I would say that January of 2022, I had just got COVID. I had just got back from the States. We went through a whole big rigmarole because we had to come back into Canada because we had an event down in the States. So we had to cross the border. Graham has COVID. So like we pull up and tested. So we know he has COVID because we're trying to do the stupid test to get back in the country and he failed it. So we pull up at the thing and they start freaking out about, about COVID tests and this and that. And I just remember, like, I was stuck doing my thing, and that's when the cops came to my house. And I want to say that was like late September or October that we were in isolation. And then they locked down for Christmas again. And I just remember in January just being like, do I just get this thing? I mean, like, at what point, where does this stop? Where does it stop? I mean, I feel like I've been in fight or flight mode now for like a year or a year and a half, just like the government is. And I, not everyone reacted the same way, or if they did, maybe it didn't come out the same way. But, you know, I'm an Indian, so this to me was like, it hit me on like a visceral level, these rules and the government and seeing the Trudeau on the TV every day. It was like, you know, some people might have thought we got a little carried away with it, but there was some sort of real visceral response to this sort of clamp down on freedom in Canada. And I would say that was, I was at the point where I was like, where is the population? Because I feel like there's more people that think like me, but everywhere I go, everything I see on social media, everything I see on the TV is saying the opposite. And it was probably, well,
it's 90% of people being oppressed by the attitudes of 10% of people being scared of taking somebody off. I doubt the cops wanted to be doing any of this, because they're thinking like, we could be actually going after real criminals, and instead we're going to some guy's house to see if he's, you know, isolating in place. And even if you lie, what are they going to do? Like, oh no, I've been here. Oh, your neighbor said you weren't. Oh, they're wrong. It's like, oh, he just wants to leave. No, I mean, like, what? Like, there's nothing about this that's at all warranted. And they were treating it like it was the absolute plague. And when you're talking about the fact that at one point you're like, do I just get this thing? Do I just get vaccinated? And then they leave me alone. It's like, what it really is, what they were doing was just like, and this happens all the time. It happens in day-to-day life when they want you to follow stupid rules and regulations that aren't necessary, but it keeps people employed to enforce them. It's just what I call bureaucratic terrorism. You know, what you do is you just keep putting paperwork in front of people, just another small rule. It's just a small thing. You just have to do this very small thing. Sir, I understand. Please just do this small thing. And then it's like, well, you're going to be doing 10,000 of those things for this person who doesn't know what they're doing or why they're enforcing it, but it's their job and they get paid to enforce it. And so that's where you get so much of society who's like just following or being pulled around by the nose by people who work in middle management and government.
Yeah, well, I mean, go ahead.
It feels like it's happening all over again now. I'm going to want to ask you about this because it does feel like 2020. I've heard it from multiple people. This has got 2020 vibes. It's this whole Team Canada thing. And again, we don't have any difference coming from Pierre to what Carney's saying, really. I mean, Pierre, because again, he's afraid to act like Trump, it feels like. But now all of a sudden they've got everybody, you know, calling people Nazis and everybody's all up in arms. And it's because the TV's telling them to do that.
Yeah, it's nervous middle-class people. If you can imagine the sort of person this works on very well, it's this nervously middle-class person who's wealthy enough that they don't really have to worry about actual concerns, but they are deeply concerned. Oh, he said something that he made it sound like Trump. Oh, you can't vote for him. He sounded like Trump. Like Trump already attacked Polyev. And even then, I would agree that Polyev, he should be on this whole Team Canada thing. He should have mocked it immediately and said, all of you people are the ones with extremely high taxes, high regulations. You guys are the ones who don't like free markets. And now you're mad at a guy for putting on tariffs. I don't like the tariffs, but it's like you're mad at Trump for kicking Canadians in the face because that's your job.
Yeah, well, and it's like, I think it's important to remember that because I'm starting the other eerie comparison to that 2020 is that people got to remember that in January 2021, a month before the Freedom Convoy, we didn't have a politician in Canada that was on our side. You know, even the Premier of Alberta was Kenny at that time. So it's basically coast to coast, the same message. Poilievre is saying the same message. Martin Shields is saying the same message until the Freedom Convoy comes out. And that convoy comes out and it becomes pretty apparent that at least half of Canadians think like I do, and maybe more. There might even be the majority. I mean, that convoy was pretty special to watch drive down the road. And, you know, then Pierre sort of switches base and he turns into this sort of populist figure that he's sort of embodied for a while there. He's kind of losing that now. But I'm worried that, like you said, with this Team Canada thing, we're slipping back into this. We have no politician. What politician? I mean,
The fundamental problem is consultants and strategists in politics. Probably during COVID, there was probably at least 150 MPs, both conservative and not conservative, who would have agreed with you that all this is completely stupid. I actually probably say more than 200 of them. And then, but you're in the Liberal Party, you can't say anything. You're in the Bloc, you can't say anything. I guarantee there's tons of NDP guys whose blue collar base of private sector workers in union workers in Hamilton were ticked off of them saying, hey, I just want to go down to the local bar. And you're saying I have to go to my job at a construction site, then go home. Screw you. And so, but the thing that you have is so many politicians, even though just doing what their gut instinct tells them to do would get them way more votes and way more attention, they focus group things. They let consultants tell them what to do. They let strategists, by the way, strategists and consultants whose records are mostly losing elections. But, well, this person told me I should circle the wagons. And because there's this Team Canada thing, I shouldn't say anything. It's like, no, just go for it. Just go for it. The best politicians in Canadian history are people who just went for it. You know, Ralph Klein, you have people like Mike Harris. Even, you know what? I almost have to give compliments to Jean Chrétien, because that guy, when he was prime minister, slashed like 30% of government spending because it was the right thing to do at the time. And he wasn't going to focus group that crap.
Yeah, we've been surprised to learn about the consultancy complex, which is really is. I mean, we saw an amazing video with the guy that was from the Boston Consultants, and he talked about how this is all intertwined. And in Canada with the so, but I'm always wondering, is their advice real or is it nefarious? I feel like they're manipulating things on purpose in a way.
My thing is that what makes it even sadder is they truly think this stuff is good. They truly think they're actually good at their jobs. What they are is that they think that just by, you know, it's like the Erin O'Toole 2021 conservative campaign was like the magnum opus of consultants and strategists. Oh, you want some moderate voters to turn out for you. You want some of the moderate liberals to turn out for the conservatives. So you should only say moderate sounding things that nobody could disagree with. It's like, that's not how people vote. There's no such thing as a voter who doesn't vote on something they're very passionate about. And you have to be passionate yourself as a politician in order to get those people to show up. So you got to be the person saying no, like this is my thing with Polyev right now. Saying a 250,000 cap on new permanent residents is still way too high. And even then, why would you run on that? Because Carney at any moment could just say, I agree with him, and then take the baton out of your hand. What you want to do with your slogans and with your policies, your platform planks, you want a few big ones that your opponent would never run on. So I would say you want to run on a 100,000 permanent resident cap. Maybe that's too low. We'll find out in 2 years, and then we can correct a little bit later. But I hate this idea where consultants are, ooh, but once that's too low. We're way too high right now. How about we see what a little bit too low looks like? Then we'll bring it back. But the thing is, all these people are like, but you're going to lose the Andrew Coyne's of the world. Like, who cares? He weren't with us in the first place. I don't think Andrew Coyne's been voting conservative for the past 20 years.
Is that part of that, like, bureaucratic terrorism you're talking about? Because, I mean, when you talk about that, we don't really have any sort of representation in Canada. We were just voting placeholders to listen to consultants.
There's a lot of MPs who really don't do it, but the problem is if party HQ ends up thinking that these people really got a good idea, it doesn't mean that they're all bad. So I would even still say right now, I would still say it's very much worth voting conservative. Are there people inside the Conservative Party who are dedicated to fumbling everything they have and listening to the dumbest people on the planet when it comes to how they should run their election and how, you know, what their policy should be? Sure, but there are still a lot of good MPs in there. But the thing is, you are right, though, that all this stuff stifles your actual ability to make change when people are convincing them that the way to make change is through very, very slight incremental change. It's like, no, when you're reforming and you're going back to something that everyone knew worked in the first place, you don't incrementally change back towards something we already had. You just do it. You know, what incremental change is what you do when you're trying to move people into doing something that's never been done before. So you got to tip, you know, you got make people tip their toe in the hot tub like a little bit at a time. The problem now is that if you're only going back to normal incrementally, that means all the crap stays in the system for longer. And if a conservative government gets in and they only incrementally change back to what is truly normal, people are going to say in 4 years, everything's barely any better. It's like, yeah, because they've been barely trying. If they just do it all, you're going to get a lot of ticked off public employees who get fired. You're going to get a lot of people who are mad because this program was canceled and it gave me $2.50 every 5 years. And I liked that for some reason. But eventually, in 2 years, like with Ralph Klein's slashing spending and paying off the debt, eventually, within a couple of years, people say, you know what? I was criticizing before, but I understand what he's doing now. Politicians have no capacity to go live in the woods for a couple of years with people hating them, but they're doing the right thing and they'll eventually come around.
I mean, we've been pretty disillusioned by the whole thing about voting. Like, we were like, you can't vote your way out of this. I mean, I was just like, there's no solution in politics. But then, I mean, you were a bit of a change in that. I was kind of listening to you. I'm like, oh, you're making sense. And, you know, you were kind of involved. But what do you think now? Is there a possibility for this change at all?
Well, wait, before we get to that, is that what's happening in the States right now? Is that what we're seeing under Trump, like a rush with Doge to make noticeable change before you're out of time?
I think that there are are you going to get things changing as dramatically as with Trump in the U.S.? In Canada, with Polyev's conservatives? No, but I think what you are going to get is 75% better. Now, I mean, because it's complete garbage right now. So I think you're going to get things pretty much back to pre-2015 with the conservatives. Is it going to be amazing? No. Maybe if there's enough pressure, they actually start doing things that I truly would say, wow, they're hitting it out of the park. But right now, just removing some taxes, removing some bad programs like the Housing Acceleration Fund, all this other stuff, all this stupid anti-gun legislation, that is at least what I would say is satisfactory for the first term. Second term, then they really have to start proving themselves that you're not just going to do what Harper did, pass a few good laws, manage the economy pretty well, and then stall. Because the problem is I am seeking to preserve them. I'm not doing it because I just want this. I'm doing this because they should, you know, I want them to stay in government. And so with Harper, the problem is that nobody cares that you did a good job 5 years ago. They want to know what you're doing now. So I want Polyev to get in and start making change, but never stop making change. Just keep making it better. There's no moment where we've won and now we just coast for three terms, because you will lose. And that's why Trudeau became prime minister after Harper, because Harper, and let's be frank, Jenny Byrne was the campaign director there, and she is still very much in charge right now of Polyev's sort of decision-making in terms of internal party stuff. That was a dead-on-arrival campaign because they just thought we deserve this government, and you can never think you deserve it.
Was there always this much corruption in Canadian politics? I mean, is there any chance that Pierre, like when you talk about these changes going on and on and on, I feel like the goal would be to get rid of a lot of this corruption and just have like a slimmer down, honest government that's transparent. Like, but I don't feel like that's going to be allowed from more of a global perspective. I mean, I really think Canada's kind of stuck being the vanguard for the WEF and Carney's, you know, companies and Carney's, the UK climate change network, all this stuff kind of feels like we'll never get to that point where we can actually just have a less corrupt, transparent government.
Well, I would say the reason why it might be more difficult to get rid of that is not because of like global forces saying, hey, you can't do that. It would be, well, that consultant's my friend. Well, this person's my friend. And that you can never get rid of the waste because yeah. Right now, even with the poly of conservatives getting in, you might have too many people saying, well, I don't want to get rid of this, you know, this bad part of government. I don't want to clean up the way that internal party elections are done because, you know, I like being able to just select my candidates rather than actually having them elected by the grassroots. And that's something that does need to change. Like you guys probably know, I ran for Calgary Signal Hill in my area for the conservative nomination. Like, let's just be clear. I would have probably won. You don't get kicked out of a nomination unless you could win. And that's the problem, is that the conservatives have a lot of great candidates. And the conservatives also grabbed a bunch of turkeys of candidates because, you know, it was just some guy's staffer. I mean, oh, it's this guy. And I know he's going to say absolutely nothing in government. It's not because they want to do that for nefarious reasons. Oftentimes, assume it's a petty reason, because humans are very petty. And sometimes people like weaker candidates getting in for certain ridings because they're never going to make cabinet. And that's good for other MPs who want to be cabinet ministers.
What was it like for you personally? I mean, making the choice to do that. And then what was it like getting kicked out? If you don't mind telling
me. Why did they kick you out? Yeah. I might have missed the story.
Because I was probably going to win. That's why they kicked me out and they wanted somebody else.
What did they give you?
What was their reason?
So they're in the background. So they're living vicariously through Aaron O'Toole era rules of the party, where it's not that they don't have to tell you. They just don't tell you why you got kicked out. I know it's complete nonsense. When I appealed, I heard that a 9-page dossier was put together to justify why I was kicked out. And that didn't go very well in the National Council meeting, because this 9-page dossier was full of basically just describing that I'm a conservative. Like, I'm not even kidding. There was nothing in it. It's like Wyatt follows pro-life groups on social media. Wyatt once, I literally said things that you'd assume would make me like ingratiated with very milquetoast conservative politicians. Wyatt once described himself as a neoconservative. It's like, okay, who cares? And then one of the points was, well, it was hilarious. It was, I criticized Andrew Scheer and the party's 2019 campaign in 2024. I was basically saying why it didn't win. That was considered a point against me that I've ever even spoken out about why we lost an election.
That sounds again, like
they, all these points were nonsense. Yeah. They knew it was nonsense. In fact, the most disgusting point is they referenced me being sued by this Chinese billionaire as a risk factor. This guy is openly known as a CCP agent, basically. Maybe not an agent, but he basically works on behalf of the CCP, or he pursues their interests. And so they're basically, and I don't even think this is the real reason they kicked me out. It was just because I was going to win, and they just need to put a dossier together of nonsense. If that dossier ever leaked, think about the fact that they basically admitted unintentionally that they care what the CCP thinks about their candidates.
What, how is that? You know, I keep hearing about, and we're going to spill into this BC thing in a minute, but I keep hearing about people getting kicked out. I mean, I don't think that the average Canadian understands that our democratic system is this flawed. Like it's been so taken over by the party. Was it always like this, or is this something that's crept in? And because I mean, you see, Canadians jumping up and down about voting. It's like, you know, you just didn't vote for the prime minister.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And when you can't just vote for the party label, because you don't exactly like, obviously still vote for the best one you can get, but so few people vote in nominations or even know nominations exist. And oftentimes nominations are not rigged, although they can be oftentimes. It's one of those things where sometimes they get played cleanly and other times they don't. And this is literally in all parties. By the way, this even happens in the PPC. Maxime Bernier will kick out candidates in favor of people who are basically bigger sycophants, people who worked harder but get kicked out for somebody who just retweets them enough on social media. It's that pathetic. But that's the problem in Canada, is fundamentally every single candidate had to go through a nomination or got an acclamation. So you can't be surprised, like, oh, I can't believe this guy's not really that conservative, or why is this person not even caring about constituents? It's like, well, it's because they never had to. I mean, they didn't have to like talk to the community. They just got the appointment, or somebody put their finger on the scale to get them in as the nomination candidate. And that's a big problem that you run into in Canadian politics, is that the biggest plot hole in the show House of Cards is that it didn't take place in Canada. Because this is a country where you can actually truly pull off some pretty scummy stuff. And, you know, people mostly don't pay attention to it. Because in Canada or in America, what happened in BC that we'll get to would be blockbuster news, at least in the province it happened in. For weeks, they'd be covering it. And they would actually be covering it properly. Whereas the situation in BC, the legacy media has their own interests in undermining the same people that the party's undermining. So they'll just cover the story badly on purpose, and then they'll move on.
Well, before we get to that, were you pushing back pretty hard, or what was, I mean, I know you said you're kind of more from a milquetoast sort of neoconservative point of view, yeah. But I feel like you weren't going to put up with shit when I heard you talking about it at the time. So were they just like,
I'm extremely open about what I did, in the sense, like, I called them out. I said, this was unfair. You can't be doing this. At some point though, you have to stop talking and just go back to your own job. And And is it right that I have to stop talking about it in a certain sense? No, it's not. At the same time, there is always that, again, you're working with nervous middle-class people in every party. Why talks about this too much? You can't associate with them. I help people all the time. I go around helping good candidates, good people, good nomination candidates, and I just continue on my merry way doing that. At the same time, also mention it. This is not something where you're forgiven. At the same time, if you ever want me, and you're willing to commit to actually having some transparency and you want to prove you're a transparent party, you can always bring me in. That's fine. But that's one of those issues where the good thing is the certain people in the party hate my guts now because I made sure the person that they wanted to win Signal Hill still didn't win. So, you know, that person I know was cheating in a few ways and they had a bunch of advantages given to them by HQ or at least people around HQ. This is also the sensitive thing. You can't, the difficulty is you can't really say it's the party because it's not really the party. It's like this one or two people who got somebody in the party to pull a string and like do something. And maybe that person didn't even want to do it, but that person's powerful enough. You're going to let it happen. And that's the problem is that you can't even call it the whole system because it's not even the whole system.
Most people in the party
and conservatives are grassroots people. And then somebody comes down from you know, the top floor and they say, well, this guy can't run. And you're like, they're like, well, and then he's like, well, do you want to be kicked out too? Are you really going to try and turn this into a big bloodbath of a fight over this guy you might not even know in Signal Hill? And I was kicked out alongside a deputy premier. Leela Ahir was also kicked out of the race. And that was what was so ridiculous about it. They just kick out multiple people, and it's just like there's no news story about it. This is basically determining who the MP in this area is going to be. You know what I mean? It's like rigging a Republican primary in rural Alabama. We know who's going to win. So you basically you rigged the general election to by proxy.
Exactly. And I guess it's riding by riding specifically. So it all depends on where you're going and who happens to be going against you at that time. And if there's other things going on with the party.
It's extremely nuanced, basically. Sometimes they can do something to you. Sometimes you're almost too big to do anything to, and they have to leave you alone. I mentioned one of them before I came onto the show. I won't mention that one specifically, but there are ones around the country where they don't want the guy, but then he gets through. And for some reason, they couldn't have stopped him. I mean, and that's the problem. And that happens literally in every party. And it's not because one party is more corrupt than the other. It's because if a couple corrupt individuals get into a party and they're willing to do some unethical things that you'd never dream of, if enough people are nervous and don't want to stand up to them, they can do a lot of damage. And that's the problem, is that when you don't have hard and fast rules about how certain things in parties are supposed to be run, they can then be manipulated. Whereas I'd be advocating that you should have Elections Canada running these nominations. They should have oversight so that you can't say last minute, actually, that guy's out. Like, they're going to say, why? There's nothing in your rules that says you can kick him out for this reason.
Yeah, that's a good point.
What about the riding thing? I mean, we don't even know where they're going to run Mark Carney yet. I've heard Edmonton. I've heard some East Coast stuff. Do you get this in the States as much as you do in Canada, where you just sort of run someone wherever you want?
In the States, I would say you could probably argue people are more aware politically. The funny thing is that we often have higher voter turnout than the Americans, but sadly, I think the Americans actually tend to the ones who do vote follow it closer. I find they are very sensitive to people not running in their right states. It's like Dr. Mehmet Oz trying to run in Pennsylvania against John Fetterman, who, you know, John Fetterman's proven that he's not actually that bad. But at the time, he's a candidate who just got over a stroke and Oz couldn't beat him. And the big hit on Oz is that he hasn't lived in Pennsylvania in like decades. And then he just bought a house there just to make it look good. And that does rub a lot of people the wrong way. And so this is one of those things where I think riding to ride, although in Canada, in nominations, when people hear that you don't live in the riding and you're like not even in the same province, or you're a 35-minute drive from being in the area, people kind of do get ticked off.
So you might have to pick a riding that's a guarantee. I mean, are they going to find a way around this, or does he even have to do it? I mean,
who does? Mark Carney. The leader tends to have, and this is, I do get it. The leader tends to have a little bit more leeway that they can do whatever they want when it comes to where they run and stuff. I'm wondering if he's going to run the Halifax by-election to get into office, because I'm skeptical. Everyone says that the election's coming on like March like 24th or whatever. It's going to come in a week or two. The problem is how does Mark Carney run away from the carbon tax if he hasn't recalled Parliament to get rid of it? Now he looks like he's obviously a liar and he's just going to tell you he'll get rid of it. And he's just going to say cancel that as soon as he wins.
I heard they don't need that for it to get rid of it.
They wouldn't need some. Well, it was an actual passed piece of legislation, so it'd still be on the books regardless. And the whole point is he could still be accused of, through executive action, he's just going to stop. He's just going to suspend the payments of it for a month or two. But that, again, looks sketchy as heck if you don't actually officially get rid of it.
What do you have any, what do you, because we're hearing all this stuff. And I mean, one of the reasons we had to have you on the show is because you're one of the people that is pushing back on these polls that everyone's sort of freaking out about, that the liberals are going to win. And I mean, we've gotten into it on the show a few times where I've used your work. I was like, well, why it says the polls are wrong. And I've been watching them for 2 years. So I'm having a hard time. I mean, when I first started watching, I think you were still under 10,000 YouTube subs. So I'm just like, I don't know. I tend to believe Wyatt, because we are, in a lot of ways, we are still just dabbling into how this system works. Like up until a year ago, I probably could have given you a better breakdown of how the U.S. political system works than the Canadian one. We've done a pretty good job of digging into it and figuring out it. If we're going to talk about it, we want to know how it works. But can you sort of, let's start with maybe some predictions and why you think the polls are wrong.
Well, here's the thing with the polls, too, is that most polling companies are trying to be accurate. They're doing the polling for free, and they're trying to poll so that when election day comes, they can say, see, this is how good our market research skills are, so they can then sell their services to other companies. So there are some pollsters, though, that I think are just totally fake. Ecos and Frank Graves, I think they left the polling industry after 2021, and they are now in the horse race industry. They like basically just buoying up the liberals, making the liberal voters more excited, more willing to donate. Rigging a poll, though, doesn't really, like, maybe he's not even rigging them. Maybe he just gets terrible results because he's bad at his job. He knows they're wrong and he still releases them, you know, like Ann Seltzer in Iowa. I even heard that was not a fake poll. She just knew it was an outlier and she released it anyways, because most people would throw that outlier out and then just do another poll to see if they can get a similar result. And if you can't even duplicate it the second time, there's probably obviously something going on that's wrong. But Ecos is totally fake. But places like Leger, when they show +3 conservative and then +13 conservative, then tie, which literally just happened these last few weeks, was their tracking number. And it's like, that's just not how public opinion works. People don't go from +3 to +13 to tie. That's why I trust right now Abacus Data and Innovative Research, because they have been slow and consistent, which is how polling tends to work. Unless some World War III breaks out and it changes everything, people tend to kind of go up a little bit and down a little bit. They've showed since Trudeau stepped down, naturally, because there was a lot of people who were so depressed with the Liberal Party, they wouldn't vote for them with Trudeau. As soon as he left, didn't matter who it was, the Liberals started trending up a little bit. Now they plateaued in their polls around 30% or 28%. Innovative puts them at like 31, 32. But they have the Conservatives still leading by 10. I think that sounds about realistic. That shouldn't make us super comfortable if we want the Liberals out, because a 10-point gap or a 12-point gap could become a 6-point gap, and that's only a Conservative minority government, probably.
How do you think that plays out, a Conservative minority government?
A 6%, I think it would be a Conservative minority government, because the Conservatives have a less efficient vote overall. So what you'd end up happening is they'd run up the score in Alberta, they'd run up the score in Saskatchewan, and then once you get to Ontario, they'd probably start losing around the GTA a little bit, they'd probably start losing some ridings around BC that they need to pick up, and then they'd maybe get to 160 seats or something like that, and they're 12 short of a majority. Maybe at that point they have to work with the Bloc Québécois, but that's why it is kind of vital for the Conservatives to secure a majority, because the problem is that I think the Liberals and the NDP and the Bloc and the Greens, their rhetoric has been so anti-conservative, I could easily see these guys going in a direction where we're going to have a coalition no matter what. Doesn't matter if you're only one seat shy of a majority, we're going to have a coalition minority government because we don't trust you.
Yeah, it sounds like that's what's going to happen. And the thing is, that's frustrating for me. Actually, I'm not going to even talk about that yet. I'll wait a little bit. But Darren, where do you want to go from here? I mean, do you want to deconstruct the polls a little bit more? Because I mean, I feel like the polls are just for a headline. I mean, the one that I think I heard you deconstructing it, or maybe it was somebody else, it was like 250 people over like 4-week period. It was like some weird rolling poll. And then the CBC or the CTV is using that just as a talking point. It's like they just want it for the headline so they can make everybody in the country think that it's neck and neck.
Well, and that's where they need to stop covering polls that swing wildly. If you're covering a poll that's saying liberals are ahead this week, conservatives are ahead this week, and it's not tight, it's like plus 10, plus 5 for the liberals, plus 15 for the conservatives. Like, that's not polling. That's not how public opinion works. None of us know people that schizophrenic. Yeah. None of us know people that schizophrenic who are constantly changing who they're voting day to day. It's what you did was you didn't have a good sample. So what you're doing is you're polling people at a downtown Starbucks lineup. They are just in Toronto at a Starbucks. You're only pulling their attitudes. And that's why I like innovative. They give people a bit of a personality test before they actually poll them. So they realize that they're not just polling a bunch of urban progressives in Ontario. They have a certain ratio that they generally try and stay within of, you know, core left, left liberals, business liberals, moderates, populists, conservatives. That should be, and that doesn't mean conservatives don't sometimes vote liberal, or populists don't sometimes vote liberal, or even core left people sometimes vote conservative because they want to punish the liberals. It happens, but the personality test proves that we probably picked up some rural people, because rural people are going to be more populist or more deferentially conservative, which is their category, deferential conservative. But the thing is that I guarantee if Leger and Ecos did this, they would find that legitimately 70% of their sample was people on the left side of the aisle. And it's impressive if there's still only there's still 3% up and you're over polling urban liberals.
And they get the gender, and they watch the gender differences and stuff too. The other guys.
Gender is a big problem for the liberals right now. The conservatives, even with the liberals climbing back up, are still getting 45%+ of men. That is a ridiculous number.
Wow.
While the liberals might even be winning with women on some polls, or it's tight at least, the conservatives might be up by one or two. The liberals need to be winning one of the genders by the numbers that the conservatives are, because the conservatives are leading with men by like 15 points, 17 points over their next closest party. It is a wipeout. And the thing is that none of those men are coming back because Mark Carney's there. Who cares? What plumber is running out of the house on election day to go vote for Mark Carney? I mean, what electrician is voting for Mark Carney? Yeah, there's some guys who are probably retired who all they care about is the CPP and they watch too much CBC News, so they'll vote Mark Carney. But still, a lot of them are not showing up. But the thing is, women are actually still more accessible to conservatives than men are to the liberals.
Oh, that's interesting. I wouldn't have thought. You think that's the same in the U.S., that stat?
Yes, actually, the most conservative voting bloc, but you just can't see it looking at the macro numbers, are married women. Married women are the most socially conservative and fiscally conservative voters.
Wow. In the States and in Canada.
Yeah. But as a general thing with men and women, and I'm talking about like married women in their 40s, they have kids who are 7 years old. They are extremely conservative. People get a little bit less conservative with age because you start to only care about, not that you should only care about it, but you get a lot of people who only care about pensions. You get a bit softer. Oh, I don't like that guy's attitude. He's harsh. I'm like, you voted for like Barry Goldwater in the 60s, and now you like think that like Mitt Romney's mean or whatever. It's like you get these people like, what the heck's wrong with you? But it's an age thing. Some people just get softer with age. Barry Goldwater, in fact, got softer with age in the 90s, where he's like becomes kind of a liberal. And I think you get a lot of older people who want to please their young grandkids who become kind of liberal. So they kind of soften up too.
Hey, that's what I was thinking too. Yeah.
Darren
was saying before we started, we wanted to ask you this, is he thinks that Carney and the liberals are going to go a little bit more towards the center here. And I wanted to see what you think about that. I'm scared of Carney, to be honest. I think with all his rhetoric about the climate change stuff and his previous, you know, posts in the banking and I mean, his wife's company, all these ties to
his craziest thing is he's in favor of central bank digital currency. I have found articles where other central bankers react to his position on CBDCs and they think he's a nut.
Yeah.
They don't specifically name him, but they basically present Mark Carney, what do you think about CBDCs? He's like, we got to get on this before the private sector does, or they're going to control the world. So we got to control the world first, like complete nut case. And then they ask another central banker saying, do you think that governments should be getting involved in CBDCs to cut off the private sector from being able to control the space? And they're like, what? No, shut up. Get out of my office. Like, and that's kind of like the, like what a normal person does. And this is why I've been coining the term Marx Carney, because the man is legitimately so left on so many policies, and people will always then push back on me. And it only helps grow my reach when they're like, oh, a former Goldman Sachs banker is going to be a Marxist. Oh, someone who's a central banker. But the thing is that by me being hyperbolic, they end up admitting to other things that they normally would have not admitted to about Mark Carney, also about themselves. Some of these people, like, I wish he was left. And but most of them, by arguing with me shortly, will admit that he is a central planner at the very least. But he's not a communist. I'm like, but that's my point. He's a central planner. I was just using the hyperbolic label to get you to admit it.
And he wants, I mean, it really feels like he wants to, you know, net zero. The climate's not going to fix itself until we reach net zero. And he's just recently saying that. I'm like, what is going
on? The Canadian climate isn't going to fix itself. He doesn't care what happens in Brazil or the UAE.
We can keep selling our coal and keep selling our other stuff to other countries. Where do you think it's going to go to the left to capture some of this? Like, how do you think this race is going to settle down here? Like, is Darren right that maybe the whole liberal thing will start like moving a little bit more center? Like, cause they've sort of stole Pierre's platform already in some ways.
The problem with them moving to center though, and I don't, if they move center, I think they'll move in a rhetorical direction, not actually in policy. But even if they move to rhetorically centrist and they start sounding even center right on certain things, the problem is that they might end up ceding territory to Jagmeet Singh and the NDP. Even if that's a completely incompetent party, you might end up ticking off a lot of what I would call the orange liberal progressives, people who conceivably may have actually been more likely to vote for Jack Layton back in 2011 or even Thomas Mulcair in 2015, who have become Justin Trudeau progressives since then. So if Mark Carney ends up stylistically sounding conservative, you could see a lot of people saying, oh, the big betrayal of the Liberal Party, even though he's more left than Trudeau.
Right. Exactly. Well, I mean, if that's even possible, I don't know if that's possible.
It seems to be possible, except he's got a little more money. He's got just a little more money. He's a bit of a dud, I find, Carney. I feel like the longer they leave him out, the more he's going to lose in the polls.
That's what the innovative research poll showed, that they're tracking approval ratings of politicians. And if you're below water as a liberal, that's danger. Because the thing is that you have so much propaganda out there from the media saying that you're such a cool, wise man, that if you start dipping below the surface, like, man, people really don't like you. Whereas with Polyev, I think they're actually tied at -4 right now for their approval ratings, their net approval ratings. -4 is perfectly fine for a conservative leader. For context, Erin O'Toole was -15, and the man still won the popular vote somehow. And with Polyev at a -4, that probably means most center-right people really like him, and the left is just incentivized to say, no, we hate him. And that's really it. So the people that actually are thinking of voting Polyev like him, whereas some of the people thinking about voting Carney don't even like him. That's the problem. Because so there's some conservatives who are willing to say nice things about the Liberal and NDP leader, because conservatives don't tend to be collectivist and they don't tend to have like hyper negative opinions about everyone that opposes them. So that's why, I mean, you're playing on easy mode when you're a liberal with your approval rating. So the fact that he's already in the negatives is terrible.
Right. Do you think they're going to drag this out and have an election later on, or are they going to call one fairly soon? And I guess what do you think is going to happen? You think that the, you know, your thought about the polls, like Pierre's still going to do it because the true polling.
I think if the Liberals were smart, they would be waiting to get him into office through the Halifax by-election. The thing is, here's a very shallow reason why they should want him to be prime minister for a couple months before they pull the trigger. Should they wait till October? No, that's a sign of weakness. It makes it look like we're scared. But you don't do it now because he needs one or two policy wins under his belt, even if minor policy wins. And what you also need is, this sounds, again, very petty and shallow, you need more B-roll of him as the prime minister. What else? What do they have right now? They have that stupid video of him going and ah with that stupid hard hat on his head. What they need him walking around the prime minister's office, signing bills, looking like he is in charge, even if he's signing nothing. I mean, they just need footage of him as the prime minister. Or right now he feels like the fake prime minister. He's getting sworn in tomorrow. And if that's the only footage they have, people are going to be like, oh, this feels very strange that he just gets inaugurated and then immediately he wants a 4-year mandate. That's odd. He has 6 more months to go.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, it's, I kind of think the same thing. I think it's, I think we're probably still heading towards conservatism. I do start to have some worries about that. Looks like, I mean, Pierre's sort of just had all the wind taken out of his sails in the last few weeks. It seems like, is that sort of what you think, or is that sort of is the media playing that up a bit? Because I mean, I agree. Pierre's saying all the wrong things. He's just kind of turning into a backbench liberal with half of them. I feel like he needs to, I don't know how to do it though, because Canadians are fickle, and I worry that we're not quite ready for what you and I and Graham are ready for. Like, let's get some real authenticity going here. Let's
that's the problem. Polyev, when he is being himself, is very good. When you can tell he's probably been listening to a couple too many consultants and focus groups, that's when everything softens up and he just starts saying carbon tax carny too many times. It's like, don't do that, because guess what? He can take that baton away from you by getting rid of the carbon tax, then you look like a fool. Every party, and again, I'm repeating myself, but it bears repeating, that you run on things your opponent would never run on. You run on big, audacious policies that get people talking. You know, like, here's a great example from Ontario with Mike Harris. Work for welfare. Who the heck in the Liberals or the NDP is going to run on work for welfare? But it gets a lot of people talking, and there's a lot of people who like that. So if you cap immigration 100,000 or 150,000, that's something that Mark Carney would never run on. But Mark Carney might run on 250,000. So the problem is you're at the risk of him undercutting you by announcing that he has, you know, I'm going to lower it to 275,000. So it's a little bit higher than you, but it makes your limit look pathetic to your own base. You run on something that he would never even approach the general area of. And do something like, I'm going to cut corporate taxes by 25%. You're already going to get attacked as the corporate guy, which I find really stupid. Who cares? If you're like, you know, being good for business in general through taxing less is a good idea. But the thing is, you're going to get attacked, but you get to make the point that, hey, our businesses can't stand up against American businesses. And all these Team Canada guys want us to get into a fight while they're too busy taxing our businesses to death. That's what you run on. You don't run on soft things. Like, the thing the Conservative Party has loved doing in the past two elections that is foolish to an extreme is they like boutique tax credits. Oh, if you install LED light bulbs in your house, you'll get $50 off your taxes. Oh, if you put your kids in soccer, here's $200 off your taxes. Like, who cares? Stop it. Some people don't have kids, and some people don't like doing that sort of nitty gritty math of figuring out how much they can save by spending more.
Yeah. Plus it sounds like influencing, you know, with different products and stuff like that. It reminds me of like the heat pump thing before, right? I mean, you know, all this pushing in the heat pumps, what's going on with all the heat pumps? But do you think the Team Canada tariff sort of battle is going to wane down a little bit? Is it going to settle down a little bit? What's your thought about that? And how that's
I think Doug Ford killed it in a little bit of a sense after he did that announcement of 25% electricity tariffs. And then he literally backed down within 24 hours after saying, this is not something I'm going to back down on.
Yeah.
He's just a fool. These people are weak. And I think that Polyev should run on the fact that so many of our politicians are weak because they've made the country weak.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we've been saying. It's been broken for a while here. And then,
like Trump. You can actually go anti-Trump. And obviously, in a certain sense, any politician, should be anti-Trump in the sense that, well, I'm in favor of Canada. I'm not in favor of America. So I'm going to do things that help Canada, not the US. But I think counter tariffs are stupid because it's kicking your own people in the face to fight back in very indirect ways against your opponent. What you should do is lower taxes hardcore and make it that you outcompete the Americans. Right. That's the problem with the Canadians Canadians in general, as one myself and you guys. So many of us want to just, you know, thumb our nose at the Americans, but never actually want to beat them. If you want to beat them, lower taxes and flood their markets with cheaper Canadian goods, you know, with actual high quality stuff that we barely pay any tax on. If we lowered our corporate taxes to like 10%, we would be doing gangbusters right now, but our corporate taxes are like 25% plus provincial amounts. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. What about the China tariffs and the lack of focus on like our tariffs to the States already, like all the dairy stuff, the supply management, is that going to start leaking through the mainstream at all? Like, is the mainstream going to take a while to catch up with like X and all the people that are talking about it on X?
Yeah. I think there are a lot of people who just genuinely don't pay attention to politics at all. It's not for any moral failing. Just they watch their shows. They, you know, they like this one Netflix show and that's what they watch. They watch a comedy podcast. They watch some, you know, lifestyle influencer, but they don't care about politics. Go door knocking and you'll realize how few people really even know what's going on at all on a day-to-day basis. Just people don't care. And that's kind of the problem is that, and I would say that that's the big propaganda value of the CBC. They are so boring. They convince people that nothing's going on.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's a really good point. So do you want to get into BC? What happened in BC there? I mean, I don't know if this has anything to do with that Mr. Sunshine baby thing, but I don't know if that's sort of all part of the same problem. That's
kind of some flavor to it all. But what went on is that the BC Conservatives could have been really good. They can still be really good. The problem is by inviting in a lot of people who are former BC Liberal / United candidates and MLAs, they ended up having a core of people who are only in the party because it was the only way of winning. And so they're the ones who have very sharp elbows in caucus and have started to complain against any blue conservative saying anything that's actually, you know, what their base wants. And so a lot of stuff that's been going on since October and November culminated in March now with Dallas Brody, the MLA from Vancouver, Quilchina, getting booted for effectively rightfully questioning the grave story about the Kamloops residential school. Are residential schools bad and abusive? Broke up families? Yes, everyone knows that. But you can't then make up other stuff and then frankly cheapen the stories of actual abuse victims by then saying, well, if you question this fake story, you're attacking them. Like, no, that's not how that works.
No, and I'll say as an Indian, it has driven up the divide between our groups already. You know, it's just become this thing because I don't give a shit. I mean, I bring it up all the time. It's like, I don't care about graves. I don't care. I don't think they're real. And even if they were real, I think that is moving the fucking dial from what we should be talking about, which is getting rid of the Indian Act and figuring out what that looks like, not just
yeah. Look in the US. I remember this great John Stossel segment where he compared Indian reservations that had basically almost socialism, like it's just a welfare state effectively that exists. You can't own your own property. You cannot start your own industry. And so everyone's broke. And it's like not their fault. They basically live in the modern Soviet Union for no reason. And then, but if you go to the places where Indians in the US don't live on reserves, they're extremely wealthy. They're extremely wealthy because they got involved in putting up power lines in rural areas. They're involved in running schools. They are involved in tons of stuff. It's really great to see. And the thing is, in Canada, the problem is so many people living on these reserves keep having activists supposedly standing up for them. Oh, we're fighting for you. We're getting what you deserve. What they deserve is for you to leave them alone so they can run their own natural resource businesses, so they can run their own utility companies. Let them leave them alone. They'll do way better if you just stop talking.
Yeah. Give them the land they're on and move on. You know, whatever that looks like. But I feel like
the individuals get the land. Each person gets a portion that's theirs. Yeah. Guess what? If it was their land originally, then that individual should have the right to sell their plot of it if they want, rather than this stupid garbage where we're saying, well, in the 1500s, we think they lived like socialists, so they must live like socialists now where they get to make no decisions. It's like, it's almost like it was a different time and place where you couldn't really just walk off into the woods yourself. I mean, so you kind of had to do everything a little bit collectively. But isn't that the most condescending thing ever? It would be like going to Norwegian people and making them live in like stupid Viking longhouses because this is what you were meant to do. It's like, no, people are meant to live how they want to live. So like, leave people alone.
Yeah, Darren's written a couple posts on that, the difference between Canada and the US. I'm sure that resonates with you, eh, Darren?
Well, yeah, it'd be better to be, I mean, if we're going to talk timelines, up until probably 80 years ago, probably up until mid-1920s, if I had to choose where I wanted to be in Indian, I'm probably going to choose Canada. But from 1925 forward, I mean, the decision to be an Indian in the States just sort of gets easier and easier and easier as they just have all these landmark decisions of giving them land, rights over their resources, actual self-governments, governance, and that includes how they're meant to evolve. You know, that doesn't mean that you're stuck in the 1800s. You can evolve that however you guys see fit. We're going to leave you to do that. And the other thing you see in the States is just a myriad of court decisions backing that up. So, I mean, people tell me all the time, well, wouldn't you rather be an Indian in the state, in the Canada? I said, no, man, it's not fucking clear. I mean, when they were doing Indian wars and all that sort of stuff back in the early 1900s and the late 1800s, like I say, different story. But for the last almost 100 years, it's been very clear that American Indians have a lot more rights than us. And I mean, this has been my sort of thing lately. And I don't know. I mean, I'm sure you're not a 51st state guy, but from an Indian perspective, it's a no-brainer. I mean, if it comes to a vote and every Indian in the country doesn't vote to for the U.S. system, they're not paying attention to their own history. I mean, I feel like we're at a turning point in a couple of ways. The Indians and the West are both in this strange position in history where they might have a chance to grab more power or more autonomy from their current ruling structures. Do you agree with any of that? Or
no, I agree 100%. And I think everything's been kept in artificial stasis because of many different factors, one of which is artificial land deals and different benefit agreements that have come from things like the Kamloops story, where a reserve where only 250 people actually live on reserve is given $86 million over the next 10 years. It's like, okay, well, now there's no reason to actually make it better. You're just going to be able to have a reserve that gets to live without actually having to figure out, you know, is the land allocation really good the way we're doing this? Is the rules and regulations really okay? Because who's going to question the people who just got $86 million? And the thing that was most insulting about that whole Wet'suwet'en situation that was going on with the pipeline is how, like, the band councils throughout every little bit of the pipelines, trajectory, because some of those reserve areas just operate more like counties and they operate perfectly well and the people are doing really well. Every single one, even the ones that had more tighter reserve control, they all voted, let's get this pipeline done. It's great for jobs, no brainer. And then you have hereditary chiefs basically like walk out of nowhere and say, hey guys, by the way, I know it's been like 85 years since we cared about our existence, but we're here to take back everything. Like, and they're like all leftist activists, of course, because of course, in the 1500s, all these people would have sounded like Karl Marx.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be interesting. I feel like the Indians in the West and the West both are entering a period where they might have some negotiating power. And a lot of that is just going to be thanks to the rhetoric that has come up out of the South of us, because they just weren't thinking about it. They're just not thinking about it. And Alberta especially is at this, because I think the Indian thing is going to get figured out eventually, you know, whether it's this decade, next decade, or 3 decades down the road. Eventually we're going to find enough. Once we start developing resources, there'll be enough money to make those things happen, I think. But the West is kind of in a precarious position where Saskatchewan and Alberta, especially Manitoba to a lesser extent, are never going to get the chance of autonomy. There's never going to be any change in this system that gets us out of the, like, I feel like we're stuck in a crib in Canada's back room, you know, and we're not allowed out of it unless the parents open the door and let us out. And I didn't ever see an end to that, because I don't know that Canada would ever let us out. But I do feel like, again, this 51st state rhetoric has got people looking into their own crap and figuring out some things about Canada that they probably just took for granted for the last, you know, their entire life. And it's like, wait, what? This happens, that happens. And I mean, I feel like Alberta is coming to the point where they have to draw a line in the sand. I don't think that Alberta can get the recognition it needs without at least threatening to leave.
Well, maybe I think you're maybe right on that. I think another way of actually trying to equalize things in Canada, and this is kind of what I do, is that you just need every province internally through their own political movements to become more self-sufficient. If places like New Brunswick and Nova Scotia and Quebec and Ontario and BC stop having these have-not economies on and off again for some of them, sometimes for most of them consistently, like have not economies. If everyone's doing well, equalization kind of goes away because we have our own production. We have our own economies. The problem with the Maritimes is that taxes are sky high. In the Maritimes, dude, if they lowered taxes severely in New Brunswick or Nova Scotia, they could probably be like a whole internet, like data sort of like a hub in those areas, because you're like really close to Europe. You're really close to New York City. You have cheap land or whatever. A lot of these places could move into so many different directions. And that's why I try and help out in so many provinces trying to get actual conservatives elected, because once you actually change the systems on a domestic level, everyone's like, well, why not get rid of equalization? Why not give the West more autonomy? Because nobody's scared anymore, because nobody thinks they're going to lose their cash cow. If everyone is their own cash cow, then we're fine. And we know it can happen because it happened with Singapore.
Well, they got a bunch of cold ass ocean water out there too. That is probably pretty handy in a data center.
Yeah.
What about John? Didn't John Rustad and those guys know that that could happen? I mean, I find it hard to believe they're surprised by the sort of the undermining nature of this whole big party and kicking people out. Like, you think they would have seen that coming?
Here's the thing. John, I think when John is himself, he's great. When John is not himself, he's awful in the sense that he listens to his chief of staff, who is a big progressive. He listens to some of the United and BC Liberal MLAs that he's known for a while. And the thing is that those guys don't really care about the conservative message. They're only here for the seat. And they'd rather change the BC conservatives into a vehicle that they're more comfortable with. People can't pretend to be something they're not forever. And they'll eventually break and they'll start wanting it to look like home again. And home is a socially liberal, fiscally liberal party that doesn't really stand up to the NDP in any substantial way. It was so pathetic watching Kevin Falcon trying to pose David Eby for his time as BC United leader. Just like, he was like, well, would you guys lower the spending by 1%? That was like basically his big stand. And what happened was that they effectively ran a struggle session against Dallas Brody, that she, because she said this thing about Kamloops, which John tried to make her delete her post about it and asked her to apologize. And then later when he kicks her out and he has to justify it, he then smears her by saying that she was mocking residential abuse victims. No, she wasn't. She was mocking the activists trying to gaslight her.
Yeah.
That was the only thing going on there. You can even tell John knows that they were trying to gaslight her because his team posted only a 3.5-second clip of what she said, in which if you took the first 10 seconds or the 10 seconds after, it would have been clear what she was talking about. They were just lying. And even in that post, he says, you know, I agree that there are no bodies in Kamloops. I'm like, why did you make her apologize then? Why did you try and make her apologize? And it's just a bunch of stupid garbage where they're trying to make the children in caucus, the liberals, happy by punishing the blue conservatives. And I think it was right for Tara Armstrong and Jordan Keeley to then go follow Dallas Brody out of caucus, because when HQ makes disgusting mistakes like this, and I am willing to think it's a mistake and not fully intentional yet, because I will let them come back and make up. But when they do stuff like this, it's good for Tara and Jordan to follow them out to maximize the pain that they have for doing something this immoral, this morally reprehensible. You maximize the pain. They bought it. They get every penny of it.
How did the elections not have to get redone there in that province? Like how did that, it seemed like, you know, they were like literally like one vote away from making a difference. And
yeah, there's still that ongoing thing in Surrey Guildford, where depending on how that court case goes down, there could be a by-election. And if the NDP ends up losing that seat in a by-election, they're now only in a minority government situation, which makes things very uncomfortable for them. But the thing was, do you know why the BC Conservatives didn't win? They ran a bad campaign. They ran on a deficit bigger than the NDP ran on. They wasted their money. HQ was full of people being overpaid for doing nothing. I was trying to get them to do things that were free. That would have been great for the campaign. No, we're not going to do it. Oh, well, you ask this person if they can do it. It's like there's too many guys who wanted to sit around HQ feeling important, but they didn't want to hit the streets and actually figure out what this campaign needs to be all about. Too many people who get inside their own head and they have big ideas and they've never implemented a big idea before.
What example? Give us an example of what one of the
guys doing media, and I know the expenses, One of the guys who's doing media for the party, and he's supposed to be doing Facebook and all this stuff, his company, at least, because I don't know what the local campaign expenses were, and oftentimes they do things for local campaigns as well as the HQ, central campaign, they were paid over $250,000. And the Facebook page for the party is still at 16,000 followers only. That's how many followers you would expect to have in PEI. There was nothing. There was no attention actually given to infrastructure we needed to build to win. Money was going out the door to people who weren't trying.
Yeah, I had a feeling you were going to say social media.
Did they just become independent?
Social media is a big thing. Here's a great idea I had that everyone even said was a good idea, but suspiciously it kept never being implemented because there is some people who are so petty that if you have a good idea, they don't want to use it because that's your good idea. I was saying, hey guys, this was before the writ dropped. I'm saying, hey guys, because I was about to go on vacation to Japan. I was saying, whether I'm here for it or I'm not, just do it. You can even take credit for it. But what you do is take 100 volunteers and bring them to David Eby's riding of Vancouver Point Grey and door knock the entire thing in a single day. It's great publicity. It freaks the hell out of David because he's going to bring a bunch of volunteers into his riding just to save himself. And no, just never did it. Never had a good volunteer data. Never had good teams going out. We won ridings that we probably barely actually door knocked just because they just weren't organized. I have this lady who's like one of the woke people in the caucus, Amelia Bowlby, who was trying to tell me, oh, actually, my election victory was historic. She almost lost Penticton. That's like a default BC Liberal riding. She almost lost it. Came within 300 votes. The BC Liberals, even in the really bad election for them in 2020, still won it with like 48% of the vote. And she almost loses it. She's like, oh, I have an independent running against me too. This was not an incumbent independent. This was just an independent who was gaining votes because she's a nasty person. And the thing is, she's now running around telling people, if you agree or you're like Dallas Brody, don't vote for the party. So if you're a conservative, don't vote for the conservative party.
It's funny because when we were in Chestermere still, before I left to no man's land here, they banned my chickens. And I was probably more considering becoming politically active than ever. And I think the lowest votes for the last seat on council, I think there's 6 seats on council. And the last guy got like 235 votes. And I was like, I can just go knock on doors. I could just go knock on 1,000 doors and I can get more than 235 votes. Because when that vote comes up, you're going to be the only guy on that piece of paper that most of them saw. You know, like nobody ever came and knocked on my doors.
Elections are all about math. And that is absolutely the math. So many people running just go and meet a bunch of their friends and they get 200 of their friends to vote for you. Well, you probably have, let's say you have less friends than most people do. You have 50 friends or whatever, 50 friends of friends who will vote for you. And then door knock and probably like 1,000 people will consider it. And you might be able to get another 300 votes. And then you might actually come in the top half of the actual finishers.
Yeah. The door knocking, I think, is a super powerful thing that they don't quite do enough of. Before we start to run out of time, I want to get your, cause I've been trying to, this keeps coming up and I feel like you'll be able to articulate it a little better than I have. Cause I'm not sure I even know 100% what's going on, but they keep talking about Pierre not getting his security clearance. And if I remember correctly, there was a pretty good reason for that. Can you sort of.
The reason was that if he read the Nisikop report on foreign interference, the rules were then he doesn't even get to tell anyone about it. He literally cannot say a word. So he could have read like crazy garbage and he's not allowed to mention any of it. Even if something happens in real life that would confirm something in the report, he can't even confirm that the report has that in it. That's the problem. And then he has to go through, he's gone through background checks before. He has been on a lot of committees where you need to have a background check. The thing is that this background check goes through everyone and your dog. And so do you trust the Liberals at this point in their desperate state that they're not going to leak something that a family member of yours did or a business partner or a friend? That's the problem. There were conservatives who got the clearance. They read it and they thought it was kind of meh, who cares? Because it's basically just covering up a lot of stuff and not really getting down and drilling down on all the details that people need to know. Like the Hoge report was complete crap when it came to foreign interference. It constantly describes all these Liberals falling in with CCP and Iranian front groups, constantly meeting with people and taking donations that are from people who are obvious like assets for other countries. And the Hoge report continues to just say, oops, oops, you know, Marco Mancino and who's the guy who's trying to ban guns all the time? Used to be the police chief in Toronto.
Oh, I can't remember.
You know, who's
the guy banning guns?
Yeah, you know who I'm talking about. Mancino. Both him and Marco were cited in the Hogue report that, oh, well, they basically held back an investigation that could have probably exposed something if it was done earlier, but they basically sat on it until the very last day to approve, like, an investigation or some sort of, like, search. And it's like, that's not by accident, guys. Like, nobody forgets to do something like that. That's somebody letting the people inside the building burn all their documents before the police enter.
I think there's a chance that this gun ban crap they're doing is creating more single issue voters than they think as well.
Well, who's that YouTuber from Canada who has like,
yeah, that's what I was talking about. He's never, ever made a political comment in his life. And now he's just come out. And I think that, I mean, you're talking about 6% of the country has a restricted gun license. 6% of Canadians have a restricted gun license. And it's probably like 20% of households are have guns. I mean, I think that's I think that there's more single issue voters that will vote conservative because of than liberal. I don't know what you think about that.
Who could guess why men aren't voting liberal? And this is a big thing. It's that it's just this kind of nanny state, soft. Well, we got to protect you from yourself, so you can't have a legal gun anymore. Even though legal gun owners are less likely to commit a violent act than the average person, but you know, whatever. I think this is definitely actually going to hurt the liberals a lot. The gun registry in 2004 started hurting Paul Martin really badly.
Yeah, I think people take it for granted, or that's probably not the right way to phrase it, but I think even in America and across in Eastern Canada, they don't realize how big the gun culture is outside of the cities in this country.
Yeah, tons of people own guns. We have less guns than the Americans, but the rate of people who do own guns is pretty high in terms of we just don't own as many of them. So in Canada, I think there still is like as many guns as there are human beings.
Yeah. I think per capita, it's real close. If you take that number down to per capita with the states, it gets pretty close. Yeah. What are the other big
per capita in the states? They're kind of crazy because they'll have like three or four per person, but we're like at one per person. We have that respectable kind of Swedish ratio.
I have more than I'm comfortable mentioning.
Swiss ratio.
Switzerland, yeah.
I have more than I'm comfortable mentioning on the show. What are the other big sort of single issue voting things that are going to come around this time that we're sort of, because people miss those, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? People miss those single voting things, I feel like.
Oil is definitely one. I think that's what's going to end up wiping out the NDP and the Liberals in Edmonton. Maybe Heather McPherson holds onto her seat, but that's a big one. I think another big one is social media. All the social media censorship, you're going to get a lot of young men out for those things, and gender policies. Gender policies are going to make a lot of minority voters, especially, unwilling to show up and vote for the socially progressive party, because every minority group in Canada tends to be very, very conservative.
More likely to just not show up than actually vote conservative, you think? Like,
I think they'll, well, it doesn't really matter as long as the ratio is favoring.
I got one last question here. So what frustrates me about the whole Canadian politics, and actually the American too, until Trump started mentioning it, but is this climate change, carbon tax stuff. I mean, our American friends were just astonished that we've been paying this carbon tax for years. Like, they're like, what? You guys are actually paying that? So, you know, I feel like no matter who's in politics these days, I mean, maybe PPC aside, but they just seem like a controlled festering op. But they can't say anything about carbon.
They don't try. My problem with
this, what seems like it, yeah.
They don't try. Like, I don't care how small your party is. At least try. I was just helping a small party in Ontario. I was helping the New Blue Party because they try, and they aren't just purity testing losers. I can be more right wing than you. Who cares? Who cares? Yeah. I'm probably more conservative than all these people are who are whining anyways. But the whole point is that, like, you know, just like. But the thing is, To get back to your other question in a second, but so many PPC guys think attitude is what makes you political, that I'm really aggressively conservative. It's like, I guarantee I'm more conservative on every issue than you, but I talk moderate.
Yeah.
Even though I am more socially conservative, I'm more fiscally conservative, I'm more all these things, but regardless.
But when could you call, speaking of that, so then this is my question, is when is the narrative going to shift enough where the conservatives, can call out climate change and carbon tax and really say, like, you know, even Daniel Smith talking about carbon sequestration. And it's like, can we not just get off a board of this, this whole narrative that we're going to be able to make a difference with the weather? I mean, it's just crazy.
I think the safe off ramp for the conservatives to go after climate hysteria without stepping into any bear traps at the moment is basically saying, I am not going to pass any environmental policy and I will scrap anyone that lowers the living standards of Canadians, because it is not the job of the government to make people's lives worse for abstract environmental goals that are so far proven to not actually be achievable through the means that they're using. I am in favor of any climate policy that doesn't lower people's standard of living. And that's a way, great way of me saying I won't pass any of them, because that's what every single one of them does.
Right, right. Okay, well, that's an interesting way to look at it. Yeah, because I mean, I'm afraid. I mean, we see these organizations that the government funds money into to do studies that then reinforce the rest of the money that goes out to these NGOs to propagate the stuff and the media. I mean, it's just this circle of funding that perpetuates a narrative that's already fixed in their system.
You're right. And that's also the funny thing about government. So many NGOs, so many nonprofits, whatnot, they get money despite the fact that haven't they already won the issue on all the circles they're interacting with? You're just keeping people employed at one point. And that's the really gross thing about Canada is 7% of our economy is nonprofits. And most of those nonprofits are government subsidized nonprofits that would not exist unless the government was giving the money, also known as fake jobs.
7%? 7%?
7% of the economy is like nonprofits. And again, some of them are normal nonprofits, but then a lot of them are government subsidized nonprofits that, again, wouldn't exist unless the taxpayer was forced to give them like a $300,000 grant every single year.
Yeah.
And but with the climate stuff, I think also the tact of saying, I'm not going to do anything that's going to lower the standard of living of Canadians, because the whole idea is, don't we only care about the climate insofar as it would make the lives of Canadians worse? You know what I mean,
yeah,
so you're making Canadians' lives worse than climate change in theory is making their lives. What are we doing? Because I feel like this line of questioning would eventually expose these people as a bunch of degrowth radicals who actually don't care about humans. They only care about, like, you know, the trees and whatnot.
I gotta play this clip now here if I can find it. I sent it over, but this is crap. Where is it? This is from. Do I not have it? Come on. Oh, here it is. Yeah, this is from the UK Parliament. And I don't know if you've seen this yet or not. I just want to make sure there's nothing crazy on my screen here because it's Facebook. How come it's not playing? Okay, there. I'm going to pause that. I'm going to come over here. I want to see, because, I mean, this is almost exactly what you just talked about when we're talking about craziness. I think this is from the UK Parliament.
Just concluded a trial of a personal carbon dioxide allowance, which, as the name implies, calculates how much carbon dioxide is produced annually in the UK, then divides that per person per day, then works out by how much that figure needs to fall in order to meet net zero goals. We have the white paper in my office that informed the trial. The whole concept of a daily carbon dioxide allowance is now out there for all to see. Conspiracy theory no more. I bloody told you so. To anyone who is advised by data and empirical evidence, not mass formation psychosis, carbon dioxide is the gas of life necessary for all life on Earth. It's plant food. The more CO2 produced, the more food, plants and trees the Earth is blessed with. The climate change scam is not founded on science. It's founded on feelings. It has become a religion for those who consider themselves above religion.
So it says the UK has just finished a carbon credit system trial that sets daily allowance for every person, a limit on everything you purchase. 20 kilograms of carbon emissions per day. Your food is restricted to 2,600 grams. Food manufacturers are cooperating by adding a carbon statement on their packaging to inform consumers how much of their allowance each product consumes.
Which MP was that in the UK?
The Aussie one.
I'll find out, and I'll. Does it say at the bottom?
The UK, or is that the U?
Yeah, no, I'm just. Yeah. It sounded like he had an Aussie accent, but
fair enough. I would wonder where he's from. I was going to say, though, with the BC Conservative thing, to wrap it up, actually something you guys should look up, because it's the exact same situation going on that happened to Dallas Brody, happening in the UK with another party that's supposedly supposed to be the big Conservative party, is go look at what's happening to Rupert Lowe with Reform UK and Nigel Farage. Nigel Farage is basically trying to smear him to get rid of him because he's more conservative than Nigel Farage is, and he's getting more attention. That's also what happens in parties so often. People are petty, and they want to get rid of people who get attention.
He's been saying some crazy shit lately. I mean, even Nigel, right?
Yeah, he was saying, like, well, we can't criticize Islam in any way, or we're not going to be able to win an election because the population, like, it grows by 75% every 10 years. It's like, dude, like, so you're not going to call out, like, rape gangs? Like, what are we? No one wants you, like, kick down the door of, like, the local mosque and start, like, debating people. We want you to, like, you know, enforce the law and stop allowing, like, basically quasi-Sharia law being implemented in certain areas of the country. I mean, like, Rupert Lowe, his big thing that got him in trouble, because this is in terms of what got him a lot of positive attention and then Nigel didn't like, was he was saying that all these Pakistani rape gang, like, perpetrators, they should be deported. Their families who knew about it should be deported, and any other community figure who had information about it and said nothing should be deported, which I think is a fair deal. If you're not a citizen, or if you're a permanent resident, or you have a dual citizenship, you should have that stripped if you're willing to put up with stuff that's that heinous. Yeah. You aren't really from the UK, it appears. Maybe it's taken us time to find out, but you basically were lying on every single citizenship application if you were willing to do stuff like this crap or even put up with it.
But instead, it's a two-tier system where, you know, your social media posts are going to get in more trouble than that stuff. So,
oh yeah, in the UK, like you know, everyone always talks about dystopian futures, and they say, oh, is it like 1984? Is it like Brave New World? It's like the movie Brazil. You know what I mean? We're just like kind of weighed down by massive bureaucracy everywhere. There's terrorism that people don't really like to talk about. And, you know, have you ever seen the movie Brazil?
I haven't, actually.
Should go check it out. It's basically like where everything is so over bureaucratized that even to get your plumbing fixed, you don't actually remove any of the old pipes. You just install new ones because you have to do too much paperwork to get rid of the old ones.
I've seen it in the Venn diagram, and the "you are here" Venn diagram for sure.
Yeah.
Well, Brookfield's huge down in Brazil. I mean, they seem to be into all the stuff they're not into in Canada down in Brazil. Pipelines.
It's a different climate. He only cares about the domestic climate.
That's right. Wyatt, this has been fantastic. We appreciate you coming on the show. Where can people follow you? Where can they find all your stuff?
The National Telegraph on YouTube. That's the fastest way of finding it. I used to write articles almost exclusively for 3.5 years, but, you know, Trudeau and his Online News Act has forced all my stuff off Facebook. So, in a certain sense, I have to thank Trudeau because he's the one who forced me to be an online YouTube rambler.
Yeah.
Right on.
The last thing they allow us still to do, it seems like, for now. I mean, I do have some concerns that Twitter's future in Canada could be limited.
No, if Carney sticks around, he's the type of person who'd be shameless enough to say there's too much misinformation.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so sad. Well, keep up the good work on YouTube. We'll recommend it.
Yeah, thanks for sure. And thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, thanks, Wyatt. Have a great day.
Take care.
And that was our chat with Wyatt Claypool, fellow Albertan. I mean, I guess you're not an Albertan anymore, but whatever. Big thanks to Wyatt for coming on the show. That was great. It was just all the stuff I hoped to get into.
Yeah, I know. It was perfect. Good little summary of Canadian. Actually, it was more than a summary. It was getting deep into some Canadian stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, he really knows his stuff. He really knows his stuff, where I feel like a lot of the other guys, and I'm not going to shit on anyone because they're all doing great work, but there's a lot of the media in Canada that are like us. They're just more media and reporting and influencing type stuff, influencer type thing. Whereas Wyatt is in the fucking weeds, man. He's
well,
like,
he went through it
helping
all
with campaigns. He's gone well, he through, went through it. He's tried to run. He's still helping out with campaigns. He's just super involved. So you sort of get that side of things you don't get from other places. So yeah. Big thanks to Wyatt for coming on the show. Big thanks to you guys for listening. If you're getting some value from our show, we are working on a new website and everything else, but you can head over to grabamerica.ca/support to support us and check us out on YouTube. Like us and subscribe us. Spam Graham, grahamacamerica.com. What else we got? The Graham America Show over at grahamerica.ca.
Audiobooks.
Adultbrain.ca for audiobooks. Contact @thecabin for trips and events. and Grimerica CBD for tinctures and gummies, which don't ship to Canada. So maybe people that watch this show probably don't care. But you can come on a trip with us, and you probably enjoy it. Other than that, we love you guys. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.